Andy Parks, live from the Washington Times.
Welcome back, 1206 at 1260 WRC. Andy Parks live from the Washington Times, indeed. And hour number two gets underway with Stephen Dinan, Washington Times political editor. Hello, Stephen.
Hello.
All right, CPAC over for another year. Big winner of the straw poll, the Washington Times straw poll, Rand Paul. Any real surprise there?
Well, no, not so much that he won. He, of course, won last year, but improved on his showing slightly. And I guess the bigger interesting thing is how much he won by. You know, last year he barely topped Marco Rubio by, I believe, 2 percentage points. I think it was 25-23.
Yeah.
This time around he got 31%, and the next closest was Ted Cruz with only 11%. Rubio had dropped down to, I believe, 6 or so. It's basically, you know, among at least these conservative activists, and these are libertarian-leaning, younger-skewing conservative activists who show up at CPAC, but among them, you know, Rand Paul is running away with this contest. Now, this year we asked, I believe it was 25 names, maybe 26 different names, and previous years we had maybe 10 or a dozen or so. So I guess, you know, the number of names we asked shows you just how wide open this 2016 contest is. But Rand Paul absolutely is getting a lot of attention and is, you know, among this crowd is the clear front runner. We should say Ted Cruz, I believe, won the previous Value Voters Summit straw poll. So, you know, between the two of them, you have the social conservatives guy in Cruz and you have the economic and libertarian conservatives guy in Rand Paul. They do sort of take from the same category of voters. We actually talked with people at CPAC who said, you know, they like them both, and eventually they may end up having to decide between them. But for now, they do have their different, you know, different constituencies.
Yeah, you know, I saw firsthand the influx of young people. I happened to entertain the idea of going to see Rand Paul speak on Friday afternoon. The show was over, so I figured I'd hang out and take advantage of some of the speeches. And I can tell you, sitting there about 15 minutes prior to his arrival, the auditorium for the most part was empty. But as we got closer, within about 2 minutes, the place filled, but it filled with all young people. I mean, most of the crowd was under 30, some of them standing on chairs when Rand Paul came out. I mean, screaming, you know, Rand Paul for president. It was really fun to watch.
Yeah, you know, and that's one of his big arguments to the Republican Party is look at the energy that and of course his father made the same argument.
Yeah.
Look at the energy of these folks. These are the people who are going to be, if the party is going to have a future, it's them. And that not only do we need them, but we need to alter our message in order to get them. And, you know, that's why the libertarian message, he makes the argument, that is the future. If you want to build a broader tent, you need to go that direction. You can't continue to stand on exactly the same positions that you've stood on, you know, the spending big on defense and using government power to impose, you know, social conservative I guess principles on folks. Those are not going to be long-term winners, and that's his argument. And you know, he's clearly there. The big question here is whether Ted Cruz will have to decide whether whether he stands more towards that libertarian side or more towards that social conservative side. Right now, we haven't seen him. He's been able to straddle that line fairly well. Eventually, he'll have to. You know, if we get to presidential debates, maybe he'll have to take a stand one way or the other, and then we'll see whether he actually directly competes for Paul's libertarian base or whether he goes more for the social conservatives, and then we'll see who's bigger in the broader scheme of things.
Yeah, okay. All right, I want to move on to a couple of other things. I saw your story on the U.S. losing track of tens of thousands of foreign students who came to study and then took jobs. I'd like to say that's comforting, but it's not. Where's the breakdown? There was a training program for workers?
Yeah, you know, this is a Government Accountability Office report, so an internal government audit, and it's safe to say the breakdown was just about everywhere. This was GAO does normally they write these reports, and you have to sort of read through them, and you do some interpreting. It's basically written in a very stilted language, and you have to say, okay, they really, you know, that really is critical when it's GAO speak. This one, there was no doubt they were being critical. They said ICE, which is Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the agency responsible for interior immigration enforcement, just simply doesn't have a handle on who these folks are. So there are about 100,000 students, or there are a million students in the U.S., foreign students who are studying on foreign student visas and exchange programs in the U.S. Of those, about 100,000 are part of, it's called the OPT program, and it is, it provides work permits for these folks to be able to do training, basically work inside of their field of study to give them some practical experience. It's supposed to be pretty limited. Obviously, you don't want them competing for American jobs, and you don't want them pushing people out of jobs. So it's supposed to be very limited. They're supposed to be able to prove that they are actually here in the field of or working in the field of study that they're doing, and they have a very limited time they're supposed to be allowed to be here. According to GAO, first of all, we don't have a very good handle on whether they're actually taking jobs in their fields of study or whether they're going beyond that. And second of all is that we really don't know how many of them are here for the right amount of time. There are folks who are way overworking their time. There are some people who don't even report their employer's name in the record. So
wow.
it's overall, it's a really, really, really
sloppily run program.
Yeah, it's not even sloppy. It's just I was going to say badly run, but it's not even that. It's just it's unclear that it's even being run at this point.
Yeah, and that prompted some immigration agents to tell investigators that program is a gateway to illegal immigration, and I'm assuming that some people are using it just for that purpose.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, visa overstays are a very big issue.
Yeah.
You have people who, and it's unclear exactly how big. We've heard of a number, 40% of all illegal immigrants here came here legally and then overstayed their visas. We've heard people sort of push back on that number. Homeland Security is actually in the middle of doing a much bigger study to figure out how much of the problem of illegal immigration is people coming here legally and overstaying. But we know these are absolutely some of them, students who come here. And in particular, you know, if you're, it's somewhat easy for a school to say our academic year is over and go tell ICE, hey, our academic year is over. Anybody who should be, who was only here on a student visa, you know, they should be heading home soon. But the work is a lot more difficult, and they're allowed to stay as much as 14 months for regular students. And if you're in a science, technology, and engineering field, you're allowed to stay up to 31 months beyond the time that your schooling is done. And so, you know, at that point, the school isn't really keeping track of you, and it's not like the businesses are coming to ICE and saying, hey, these folks have exhausted their time here. So that's why this is a particular danger, is that when they're all in school and in class, at least the school presumably has a good handle on where they are. Once they're out working after they're done schooling, well, nobody has a good handle on where they are.
Who's going to fix it?
That's a good question. The Homeland Security Department, so GAO listed about a half dozen recommendations. Homeland Security said, yeah, we agree with all those recommendations, but, you know, we'll see if it ever gets done. This is one of those standard things where you hear the recommendations and they almost always promise to fix them all, and then two or three years later, GAO comes back and says, here's an update. You only did two of the six.
Yeah.
Get on it.
There's another headline that managed to get one of my eyebrows to lift a little bit, and that is the Border Patrol chief says agents can still shoot at rock throwers. I didn't even know we were doing that, but I'm all for it.
Well, so it's been a very hot debate for the last few years, and there are a couple of people every year who get killed by Border Patrol agents, and these are, you know, oftentimes they're shooting into the Mexican side of the border, which is obviously a touchy subject, and these are folks who, I don't know if you've seen these photos of the border wall, and sometimes you will have folks on the Mexican side climb to the top of the Mexican side of the wall and throw, we call them rocks, but that does a little bit of a disservice to it. In some cases, they're giant boulders that require two hands, you know, 30 pounds, called rocking incidents is what they're called, and they drop them on top of Border Patrol vehicles and do some serious damage to vehicles, and, of course, occasionally try and drop them on Border Patrol agents' heads. And so the question is, can the Border Patrol use deadly force to respond to that? How dangerous is a rock-throwing incident, or maybe more appropriately, a boulder-throwing incident, and can they respond by shooting their weapon at these folks? Is it considered an actual threat to their safety that they can respond to a rock with a gun? And that strikes a lot of people as a bad precedent to say, okay, you know, it's, you know, bring a gun to a knife fight. Well, you brought a gun to a rock fight. Yeah, but the agents say, look, we can be killed by these things. These are, or at least do very serious harm to us by these if they are to strike us on the head. And they do major damage to vehicles, can smash windshields, that sort of thing. You know, if this is happening, we should be able to use deadly force to stop an assault. And the Border Patrol agents, their defense of this is, look, everybody's focused on the method of assault. The key point here is it's an assault on a law enforcement agent from somebody on the Mexican side into the U.S. Why wouldn't we respond with force? So very touchy subject. And then the big news out of last week is that the Border Patrol has not yet ruled that out and doesn't appear to be ruling out that use of force. Though they did say take extra care to make sure that we're actually talking about rocks, deadly force from the rocks.
Yeah, and the argument for keeping the policy, obviously, is that if you stop confronting the rock throwers, it's only going to get worse.
Yeah, that and the other issue, the agents say, look, the reason they're throwing rocks is not just because they hate Border Patrol agents. Oftentimes it's because they're trying to clear Border Patrol agents out of an area so that they can do their illegal activities, whether it's just, human smuggling or drug smuggling or whatever. Mm. And so the rocks are they're a signal that bigger activities might be about to go on. Well, that's why you want Border Patrol agents to be there and to stay there. And in order to do that, well, they may need to defend themselves.
Man, oh, man. All right, Stephen, well, listen, thanks for your help on all three stories. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Andy.
Stephen Dinan, Washington Times political editor, 1217-1260 WRC. It's Andy Parks live from the Washington Times. I'll be right back.